Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to the Best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We begin today's program, the first for 2019, with a new story. Covering a court case in China couldn't be any more different than any other country. Journalists are unlikely to get into the courtroom building, let alone the hearing room. Then there are the spooks and the fake news crews. Here's this story by Bill Bertels, the correspondent for the ABC in Beijing, China.
The city of Tianjin in late December is an icy place to be. Stinging winds howl through the picturesque streets, chilling you to the bone. It's not the sort of place you want to spend half a day standing on the street for work. But recently I travelled there for a court case, and I full well knew I'd get nowhere near the actual court. One of China's most prominent human rights lawyers was on trial, a bloke named Wang Qianzheng, who'd taken on a few too many sensitive cases in his career. China has quite a few lawyers like him, but his case is particularly interesting. The cops arrested him 3.5 years ago and have only just put him on trial. That's not normal, even by the standards of China's opaque legal system. Worse yet, he's been held incommunicado. His wife and young son haven't been allowed to visit him in jail. Officially, he's charged with trying to bring down the communist state, subverting it by working with an overseas NGO to train lawyers, and by representing followers of the banned spiritual practice Falun Gong. His case is so sensitive, authorities abruptly announced the trial on Christmas Eve, when many foreign journalists and diplomats were away. On Boxing Day, I arrived in Tianjin to cover the trial. I inevitably get picked up by 4 plainclothes police officers who demand my passport and journalist card. Previously, when 19 employees of Australia's Crown Group were put on trial in Shanghai for breaking gambling laws, I jumped through all the application hoops, only for the court to tell me the trial room was too small for media. The cops in Tianjin advised me not to stay there long, but legally there was no reason for them to stop me hanging out on a road near the court. So I kept going and ran into 2 more plainclothes police who wanted to see my passport. Eventually I found my colleagues along with a smattering of foreign media and a few chilly-looking diplomats on the footpath opposite the court building. The diplomats from Europe and the US had applied to observe the trial, but were told it's not open. It's common for dozens of plainclothes cops to turn up and film the journalists outside these sensitive trials. There are plenty of police too who follow you around, stand close, and try to eavesdrop on your conversations. But this trial had something I'd never encountered before. This is the sound of a TV reporter racing up to our camera and blocking the lens with her microphone. She's saying, "What a high-tech looking piece of equipment you have." And then her cameraman shoves his lens onto ours, blocking the shot. And there's not one, not 2, but 3 of these fake TV news crews with big professional cameras roaming around harassing the foreign journalists. For example, you'd set up a shot to film a piece to camera, and one of their cameramen would stand right in front of the way of the lens and pretend he needs to film something. Or they'd walk up to my colleagues and ask them a barrage of questions about whether or not they are really Chinese. When my cameraman, Steve Wang, refused to engage, they tried a new tactic, calling him a traitor for working for the foreign media. Things almost turned comical when an older man turned up and started voicing support for the lawyer on trial, creating a commotion that the police and plainclothes security goons didn't know how to deal with. It seemed they wanted to pick him up, throw him in a car, and get him out of there. But with the world's media surrounding him, they hesitated. All up, it seems the fake TV news crews had a mission: to irritate and disrupt the foreign journalists and diplomats. As the hours ticked by, we were losing hope of finding out what was actually happening inside the courtroom. Wang Qianzheng's wife had sent a message that morning saying security thugs had surrounded her apartment to prevent her from attending the trial, so it's not as though she knew what was going on. Wang's court-appointed lawyer wasn't answering calls. His previous lawyer, who the family had appointed, is now in jail, so it's not as though I could ring him up. Finally, the court issued a statement confirming the trial had begun, but said no details would be forthcoming as it involved state secrets. So we packed up, bid farewell to the fake camera crews and the spooks, and caught the half-hour bullet train back to Beijing. And on the train, I pondered, what is the point of covering a trial like this for an overseas audience anyway? After all, people in Australia don't really care about an obscure Chinese lawyer they've never heard of. But the way his case and trial is being conducted serves as a good reminder of the reality of China's legal system, especially as China becomes more and more influential. It's cases like Wang's that ultimately sunk a Chinese push for Australia to ratify an extradition treaty with Beijing last year. And while I assumed it was going to be a closed trial, you can't really say so unless you turn up and try to get into the courtroom to prove it. 2 days earlier, on Christmas Eve, as this trial was just being announced, I was talking to a veteran correspondent here in Beijing who said there's nothing worse than spending Boxing Day in the cold, waiting outside a court you've got no chance of getting into. Then he said, actually, you know what would be worse? If we all got there and they let us all into the courtroom, then we'd actually have to do some court reporting in Chinese. That wouldn't be easy either.
And that report came to us from Bill Bertels in Beijing. We now go to this week's Best of Media Network Plus program. This edition was originally broadcast on the 7th of January, 2012.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio, heard around the world on satellite, shortwave, online, and on great partner stations in over 22 countries. Many people around the world were surprised on December 19th when the Korean Central News Agency announced the death of Kim Jong-il. He'd been ill for some time after suffering a stroke in 2008. What surprised many North Korea watchers was the quick response from the DPRK just 2 days after his death in transit on his personal train. But experts have said this could be false information. Satellite pictures taken over Pyongyang show that at the time of his death, his train was not even moving. It was stationary in the capital. Keith has been to the DPRK and has been paying close attention to media from the North. He joins us now. When was the announcement of the death of Kim Jong-il, and how was it done? And was it different from when his father, Kim Il-sung, died?
Well, the announcement itself happened on December the 19th at just after 3 hours GMT, or around that time. Kim Jong-il himself died on the 17th, and it took them a couple of days to probably come out with the official party line, that's the Workers' Party of North Korea, to decide what they are going to say. When I heard the announcement, I was just in the process of listening to the news on Radio Australia, and partway through the bulletin, you can hear some paper being handed to the announcer, and the announcer just said, we have unconfirmed reports that Kim Jong-il has died. We'll have more later on in the program. And that was it. When I heard that, I went to the website for CNN and BBC, and they still hadn't put it up yet. It was only until about 20 minutes later. The difference, I think, between the death of Kim Jong-il and his father, Kim Il-sung, in 1994 is really not that much. I think the only big difference was the time delay. Now, in 1994, I remember it very well because I was in Cuba. We received a notice that came over the wire services that Kim Il-sung had died. But when you look closely to it, there was almost a five-day delay from when he actually died to when they actually made the announcement. That was probably the major difference.
The Central Committee of the Workers' Party of Korea, the Central Military Commission of the Party, and the National Defense Commission, the Presidium of the Supreme People's Assembly, and the Cabinet of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, inform you with deepest grief that the great leader Kim Jong-il, General Secretary of the Workers' Party of Korea, Chairman of the National Defense Commission of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and Supreme Commander of the Korean People's Army, passed away from a sudden attack of illness on the road of field guidance at 8 hours 40 minutes on December 17th, 2011.
Why do you think that they were able to do it sooner with Kim Jong-il?
Well, North Korea, as you know, has been in the spotlight quite a bit. Over the past 2 years. The first thing, of course, is when he named his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, who's estimated 28 or 29 years old, nobody knows for sure, as his successor. He's had some major health problems. There's the ongoing six-party talks over North Korea's nuclear program. There was the shelling of an island that belongs to South Korea. So I think what they wanted to do, because North Korea had been in the news so much, was to try to get this information out as soon as possible. And they did it. And they did it.
So it was just 2 days then that before they announced that the son of Kim Jong-il, that being Kim Jong-un, was the leader.
Yes, but you know, if you speak to a lot of, say, North Korea watchers, even though the announcement was made on the 19th and they said that he died on the 17th, people are speculating, well, you know, knowing North Korea and what it is and how they handle the process, they said it wouldn't be surprising if he had actually been dead for quite some time, but they just decided to choose that date to make the announcement. Nobody knows for sure, and I don't think that we will ever know for sure, but the speculation is there.
What is the new leader's title?
Ah, the titles. Yes, they love the titles. Kim Il-sung, the father and the founder of the DPRK. He is known as the Dear Leader, and he's also the Eternal President. Mm. His son, Kim Jong-il, was called the Great Leader and then the Supreme Leader. So he had two titles. His son, Kim Jong-un, is now known as the Supreme Commanding Leader of the DPRK.
I wonder how long before they start recycling.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was North Korean television showing?
On the day of the announcement, when the Central Broadcasting System in North Korea announced it on television, an announcer went on the air to read an official statement from the Korean Central News Agency. And all information that exits North Korea about North Korea goes through the same agency. It doesn't matter in what language it is. It's a carbon copy translation, so it's word per word. And what they showed is this woman announcing the death, announcing that, you know, when this happened, the sky changed color, and she was being very emotional on air. After the announcement was made, they went to play some revolutionary music, and then for about 24 to 48 hours, they were playing and showing video of people and their reaction of the crying in the street. Now, you know, when we hear about leaders around the world and news organizations, let's say, if a leader in the West dies, will say, you know, a lot of people were emotional and crying in the street. But this is nothing to what the North Koreans were showing. And I have a little excerpt right now to give you a sort of an audio illustration of what it was like.
Oh!
And there we heard, Paulette, you know, the outpouring of emotion that was taking place in North Korea with the death of Kim Jong-il. A lot of experts that I spoke to when this was going on said, you know, a lot of it is genuine, but at the same time, you need to take everything, as the old saying goes, with a grain of salt. a number of North Korea watchers, including Mike Shinoy, who worked as a CNN correspondent for more than 20 years, who's an expert on North Korea, he's now working as a professor, and they actually analyzed video that was coming out on satellite from North Korea, analyzing it frame per frame per frame. And they realized, you know, yes, a lot of it was genuine, but there was also a lot that was directed and made to seem cinematic, because when they analyzed the video, in each shot of the video, they can see reflections of what was going on behind the camera. And all the emotions were in front of the camera, but behind the camera, it looked like people were just talking. And then as the camera panned, all of a sudden people's emotions changed.
Now, this sounds to people in the West, this sounds very reminiscent of what we perceive to be propaganda in China, Cuba, the former USSR, and other states, former Eastern Bloc states. How is, now in conversations we had before, you said that North Korea is like that, but different. How?
Very different indeed. If you look at Chinese media from the Cultural Revolution, yes, of course, there was a lot of propaganda. If you look at media in the Soviet Union, especially during the height of the Cold War, yes, there was a lot of propaganda. You went to Ukraine in 1984. You remember what it was like in Ukraine in 1984, mm-hmm. and Cuba as well. But very, very different. Different in the sense that in the Soviet Union, a lot of people that saw the propaganda either on television or in the cinemas knew that this was propaganda and nothing but rubbish. Mm-hmm. They knew it. Mm-hmm. You know, in China as well, I remember speaking to a colleague of mine that I worked with at China Radio International. We were covering this tourism convention together in Beijing, and North Korea had a stand, and they were showing videos from North Korea, and he said, you know, when he sees this stuff today happening in North Korea, he says it makes China look like a democratic country in the 1960s and 70s. Wow. That is the huge difference. If you compare it to Soviet propaganda in the 60s and 70s, it makes the Soviet Union seem like a democratic state, which it wasn't, but it makes it seem like it. That's how different it is.
Now, the Voice of Korea is the DPRK's international service. What is the difference between them and other shortwave services?
Well, other international broadcasters are extremely different. Even Radio Havana Cuba, even the Voice of Vietnam, even China Radio International cannot compare to Voice of Korea. Voice of Korea is not just the voice of the government, but it's also the voice of who's ever in power. It was the voice of Kim Il-sung. It was the voice of Kim Jong-il. It's now the voice of Kim Jong-un. And basically what they call news is 20 minutes of what the leader did that day. Everything from congratulatory messages from these communist parties, like, for example, on the 20th of December, they read a message from the Communist Party of Canada with their deep condolences for the dear leader. They also had which was an odd one. It was from the Communist Party of New Zealand, which has approximately 5 members, and they read this statement for 5 minutes from the Communist Party of New Zealand, which has 5 members, saying they were showing their condolences to the Korean people for the passing of Kim Jong-il. So this is what their news is. And it doesn't matter, even if it's during their cultural segment, there is going to be something about, quote-unquote, the dear leader. If it's going to be about sports, there's going to be something about the dear leader. There's a funny clip that I have from a few years ago. It was from 2008. And it was about the North Korean Olympic team getting ready to go to Beijing for the 2008 Games. And in the sportscast, they actually said, and I quote, The great leader Kim Jong-il is a championship Olympic swimmer, but is unable to partake in the 2008 games because of his serious duties at home at fighting Yankee imperialists.
Oh my goodness. Now, people in China and the former Soviet Union all were able to recognize the farcical nature of this propaganda. Do the North Korean people see through it too? Or do they actually believe it?
You know, that's a very difficult question. Unfortunately, and this is the sad thing, sadly, North Korea is so cut off from the rest of the world, unlike the Soviet Union and unlike China during the 60s and 70s. It is incredibly cut off. And there's generations of people, the only thing they know is Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. They don't know anything else. And from an early age, this is what they're taught. Now, there of course are people that know this is, you know, nonsense. And you hear that from defectors that managed to get out of North Korea. They say, there's actually a group of us in North Korea that know this is nonsense. But they'll say at the same time, there are people who really believe the stuff put out by the Korean Central News Agency and the Workers' Party.
Well, I think that was the case as well in former communist states. There is always an element of people that do actually believe it. Do the people in the DPRK have access to other foreign media, to the internet and Voice of America, BBC, World Service, and others?
Well, in the last few years, internet cafes have started popping up in Pyongyang. The difference is, okay, we call it the internet. We could connect to any website anywhere in the world, even to websites out of North Korea. In the DPRK, it's called internal net, which is a rough translation from Korea, from Korean. And basically, the internet in the North Korea only accesses North Korean websites. Only accesses North Korean websites. So people who do go to these internet cafes, and they're not cheap, they're very expensive, can only access something like 20 or 30 different websites, and they're all government propaganda websites or company websites that also have government propaganda.
So for the North Koreans who do find out what's going on in the rest of the world via foreign media, how do they do it?
Well, they do it by a very old technology, which is shortwave radio. In North Korea itself, unlike other countries, radio sets sold in North Korea are pre-tuned to government stations, and you also need to register the radio at the police station. In apartment buildings, they have radio and television fed in by cable, and the radio that's fed into apartment complexes in Pyongyang, you can't turn off. You can turn the volume down, but you can't turn it off. There are a number of North Koreans now that have been able to access shortwave radios. A number of groups in South Korea, what they will do is they will send these balloons facing North Korea that will contain a shortwave radio, some U.S. dollars, and information about South Korea and the rest of the world, including DVDs and everything. Mm-hmm. So they access them that way. The other way is by buying a shortwave radio on the black market that's smuggled in from China.
So is that what the U.S. dollars are for in the balloons?
The U.S. dollars is probably to, I think, more than anything, buy food on the black market. Because as we know, North Korea has been going through an extreme famine since the mid-1990s.
So there is a black market that's thriving in North Korea.
There is a black market that's thriving in North Korea. Radios are a very hot commodity, especially the ones that are smuggled across the border from China into North Korea. The prices are completely outrageous. From defectors that spoke about this, said that, let's say a shortwave radio in China would cost you maybe, say, $20 or $30. In North Korea, the same radio will cost you nearly $200.
Oh, wow.
And defectors have said, people will do anything to try to raise the money to bribe officials to get these radios across so they have access to information. It was recently discussed among some international broadcasters that target North Korea, saying, how many people listen? The reality, of course, is we don't know. Nobody knows. And it was pretty much the same thing with the Soviet Union. The Voice of America for years had no idea how many people listened to the Voice of America and Radio Liberty in the Soviet Union. It wasn't until the collapse of the Soviet Union when they found out that their audience was in the millions. It was just in the millions. So North Korea is also in a similar kind of way. Now, the North Koreans do try to jam broadcasts from the Voice of America, BBC, Radio Free Asia, the South Korean freedom stations that target the North. But because of the fuel shortages that are in the DPRK, the jamming is not always effective. It is not always effective. There could be maybe 2 or 3 days of jamming, but then maybe after that there's no more power at the jamming facility, so then there's no more jamming going on. And the jamming that the North Koreans are doing is not as efficient as, let's say, some other countries like China. The North Koreans are not very efficient at it. So the jamming can be heard outside of North Korea, but probably in North Korea itself. But like I said, we don't know for sure. It's probably not effective at all.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of the Best of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until then, 73 and 88 to the ladies.